Welcome back to Old Blood. I'm your host, Elise, and today I have part two of The Wallpaper Widow, The Murder of Mary Emslie. If you haven't heard the previous episode, number 52, yet, please go back and listen to that one first. If you don't, you'll just be very confused today and then leave me a bad review. Mullins might have been the most vilified of the suspects, but he had plenty of company. There were many neighbors who resented Emslie and knew all about her routines, along with all those who worked for her and with her. And then there were all of Emslie's relatives. The old lady had not been close to them, but with her death, a slew of people came out of the woodwork, wanting a piece of her inheritance. First, there was the shoemaker Samuel Williams, Emslie's brother's oldest son, who applied to be recognized as next of kin. He did have the best claim on Emslie's property, but he was having a hard time finding the correct documents to prove so at the time. Samuel also had a younger brother, who was initially suspected of the murder because he allegedly had a bad character, and had previously written to his sister asking if Emslie was dead yet, because he wanted to inherit some of her money. Little brother was investigated and then dismissed. And then there was Elizabeth Gotz, the niece closest to Emslie and the one whom she got along best with, but as she was a woman, Samuel Williams still had the better claim. Neither of them were well off, and both badly needed the money. And then there was William Rose, who had been Emslie's solicitor. He testified that Emslie had owed him money at the time she died, suggesting that he should also get a part of her estate. Joseph Biggs, who helped the old woman with her correspondences, since she was illiterate, also told the court that Emslie said on several occasions that she wished him to have some of her money. As if this were not chaotic enough, the goddamn English crown also put in their claim to Emslie's inheritance. The Queen's proctor would even go so far as to claim that Mary Emslie had been a bastard, and as a bastard, her properties would all revert to the crown. Whitehall had been discussing Emslie's inheritance ever since they heard of her murder, according to McKay, leading to the Times to theorize that, in all probability, the whole of the property belonging to the deceased will revert to the crown for want of kindred, and assuming she has died intestate. Which she had. Emslie never got around to making a will, despite all of her promises that she would. Some would speculate that her discussing her will was just Emslie's way of teasing people. Like, she got a kick out of seeing what other people thought they were owed of her property and money. As much as she may have liked to play with people's emotions and test their loyalty, the truth was that Emslie had been going around for a while, telling everyone that she planned to leave all her money to charity. This was confirmed by her lawyer, Mr. Rose. The police report just after the murder recorded Mr. Rose telling this to the police, concluding that she had made up her mind to make a will to build almshouses with the whole of her money and not leave anything to her relatives, which fact the deceased had talked publicly about, and all the relatives knew of it. When the trial began, Mr. Perry, for the prosecution, began with a statement about the evidence collected against Mullins, already sensing that some would have trouble connecting the evidence to the accused. A crime of this kind is generally committed in secret, and no other human eye witnessed it, Perry argued. In order, therefore, to secure a conviction for a crime thus secretly committed, the prosecution has to rely on a number of facts, each of greater or lesser importance, but all pointing in one direction and one alone. This is what is called circumstantial evidence. This isn't exactly how I would describe circumstantial evidence, but it was how Perry wanted the jury to think of it, because circumstantial evidence was all they had. The most damning evidence against Mullins is the fact that he knew where the parcel, full of Mrs. Emsley's stolen property, was hidden. Most of what was inside the parcel had little to no value, but Perry argued that whoever had stolen the parcel items and hid them there must also be the killer. This isn't necessarily true. There could have been several people involved in the crime, and there are numerous reasons why the one who hid the parcel should not automatically be thought of as the murderer, but Perry sensed that most of the jurors would connect the two anyway. If you recall, one of the items inside the parcel was a check for £10 that Emsley had collected the day she vanished. It was written by a Mr. Carrier for a shop he rented, and when he wrote the check, he mistakenly wrote that the date was the 14th. This check, signed by him and dated the 14th of August, was found in the parcel. The other items inside could have been stolen from Emsley or her home at an earlier date. But as the check was written the day she was supposed to have been killed, it does seem like there is some connection between the murderer and the parcel, though what that connection is the case's central mystery. One piece of evidence was a silver pencil case, which had gone missing from Emsley's home along with the check, again of relatively little value. There was a commotion over the pencil case because at first it was believed to have a spot of blood on it, but then the investigation found that it was not. The pencil case was identified by Mr. Biggs, the widow's sort of secretary. He remembered the pencil case as he had borrowed it from Emsley before and returned it. Emsley offered the case to Biggs, but he declined it, saying it was a bit old. Biggs thought she might have tried to sell it to someone else afterward, for she often sold the things she no longer had use for. At the trial, the landlord of a Chelsea pub, Thomas Pryor, testified to purchasing the silver pencil case on September 8th from a Mrs. Catherine Mullins. So, the pencil case had come from Mullins. But the question was, had he stolen it, and was it stolen when Emsley was murdered? Then there was the mysterious boot. It reportedly was flung out of a boarding house window where Mullins had been staying. Everyone knew that the police were searching for a boot to match the bloody footprint, and at first it seemed as though Mullins had flung the boot out of the window to get rid of evidence. The police recovered the boot and compared it to the floorboard cutouts and declared it was a match. Sergeant Tanner got very excited because he could see where two nails on the bottom of the boot corresponded to two etchings made in blood on the floorboard. The boot was examined and found to have a hair stuck in its sole, a hair the same color as Emsley's had been. Other circumstantial evidence included Mullins' plastering hammer, collected from his rooms just after the murder, and the ribbon found on the parcel and on Mullins. Several had claimed to see Mullins in the early hours of August 14th, but they both described him wearing a type of hat that Mullins never wore. They also claim that Mullins was suspicious-looking and had something big and bulky in his pockets. Both testified to the bulkiness of his pockets, and yet the parcel had been a small one. It's also unclear why Mullins would murder a woman, cram his pockets full, and then hang around in public for people to see his bulky pockets. Clearly, the sightings came to nothing, and ultimately there were no eyewitnesses who saw Mullins at night. There were witnesses called to describe Mullins' behavior before and after the murder, however. Walter M.'s teenage daughter, Susanna, told the court that she remembered seeing Mullins around the brick fields they lived on, the day before police visited her home and arrested her father. Quote, "He was looking down on the ground as if he was in search of something. I saw him about a quarter of an hour," end quote. Mrs. Emsley's charwoman, who came to clean the home once a week, testified to seeing Mullins about a week before she was murdered. On August 4th, Emsley received large amount of wallpapers, which were delivered to her home, and then carried up the stairs to be stored in the lumber room where she was later murdered. The charwoman testified that it was Mullins who was there when she received the wallpapers, and it was Mullins who lugged them all upstairs and was paid 6 shillings for his work. Around the same time, Mullins had been at work in a tenant's home and complained to her about Mary Emsley. Elizabeth Fuke recalled, "When he came, he said Mrs. Emsley was a miserable old wretch, that she sent men about to do work, but she did not always find them the materials to do it with." When asked what she meant, Mullins explained that he needed cement to finish a job. Fuke gave him money to get the cement, and when he returned, he continued complaining about the old widow. He gossiped that he had seen her that morning, eating a breakfast that not even he would sit down to eat. She had all the money in the world and wouldn't even spare herself the simple comfort of milk in her tea. It disgusted Mullins, but truly, most of the neighborhood felt the same. The day she was allegedly murdered, she had a confrontation with one of her tenants, Smith, who had said, "I'll serve the bitch out." One of her rent collectors, William Rowland, intervened between Emsley and the tenant. Smith, described as a lame man with a crutch, Rowland noted, "It was not an unusual thing for her to quarrel with her tenants." Rowland had heard people talking shit about the old woman, but hadn't personally heard anyone threaten her. Regardless, Rowland reported, "She has told me that they threatened her." And this was what Mullins' defense would try to drive home. More than a few people wished Emsley harm, and more than a few people had the opportunity. As security conscious as Emsley may have been, with her yelling down to strangers below before she allowed them in, she had recently made a decision that beckoned strangers into her home. After Emsley purchased the wallpapers, potential buyers began visiting Nine Grove Road to take a look at them. In fact, after the charwoman saw Mullins bring the wallpaper in, she also saw potential buyers arrive to browse the selection. It's almost reminiscent of the dark strangler Earl Leonard Nelson from episode 49. The way he gained access to the homes of all the women he murdered was through responding to for sale or for rent signs he saw in windows. Emsley was inviting strangers into her home because she wanted them to buy her wallpaper. Mr. Best, representing Mullins at the trial, along with Mr. Palmer, reminded the jury what kind of prejudice Mullins faced as an Irishman. Mullins belonged to that class of society in which they might expect a man guilty of murder, and agitated and excited about it, to have taken refuge in liquor to drive away his care. But nothing of this kind was traceable in his conduct. In other words, society expected Mullins to resort to alcoholism during the ordeal because he's Irish, but he didn't do this. Instead, his conduct had been admirable. So he must be innocent. So Mullins was seen in the neighborhood on August 13th. He worked there, didn't he? And yes, he was at Emsley's house from time to time, because he was hired by Emsley to complete certain tasks. But so were many others in Emsley's home, and they were not put on trial for their life. As to the evidence, the defense claimed there was little to connect Mullins to the crime, other than his involving himself in the investigation. The hammer found in Mullins' home had been lying out in the open without any attempt to conceal it. Furthermore, there was not a drop of blood found on it. How could Dr. Gill be so certain that Emsley was killed with a hammer of those exact dimensions? Didn't wounds swell? And wouldn't that mean that the actual murder weapon should be a bit smaller than Mullins' hammer? And if this were the hammer used, shouldn't it have been impossible for Mullins to erase every drop of blood from the weapon after he had allegedly beaten an old woman to death with it? Blood sprayed the entire room Emsley was found in, and yet we are to believe that Mullins successfully washed every pore and groove of the hammer and left it in the open for police to find? Mullins swore, "My hammer was not used by me in any way to hurt any man, woman, or child." Mullins would never fully explain his involvement with the parcel, or why his wife had sold Emsley's old pencil box. But his defense did their best to swat away the prosecution's claims. As to Mullins having shoelaces that matched the parcel's strings, it really wasn't that big of a deal. Even the judge had to admit that these ribbons were found everywhere. What of the bloody footprint and the boot flying out of the boarding room window? Mullins maintained all along that it was not his boot. His children even testified to the fact that he did not wear such boots. It also became apparent that said boot was flung into a hole of some sort, which was full of dust and rubbish and all sorts of things. The hair that the prosecution found inside the boot could very well have come from this pit, and the defense reminded the jury that plasterers often mixed hairs into the plaster. It might even be horsehair, for all they knew and could prove. His children also testified at the trial as to their father's whereabouts on the night of the murder. 16-year-old Thomas Mullins told the court that on the evening of August 13th, his father left work at around 6 and returned to them at the boarding home at around 7. Younger son John also recalled this and remembered eating breakfast with his father the following morning. The problem with the son's testimony is that the boys were nervous and kept making mistakes and having to backtrack. Thomas had to retract a statement about Big Brother James being at home at the time of the murder, then later said, never mind, he had left several weeks before. And the younger son could not remember what they had for breakfast the morning of the 14th. Because the Mullins children kept stumbling over their own words, they came off as untrustworthy. Ultimately, Mullins' greatest defense, and what would keep this case alive and debated all these years, was doubt. Doubt fueled mostly by a neighbor glimpsing a hand opening a window. Carolyn Barnes never wavered in what she saw early in the morning after Mrs. Emsley's murder. At the inquest, she had testified, "I saw the window of the front room at the top of the house opened on the Tuesday morning." They likely asked what exactly it was she saw the window doing because she responded, "I mean, I saw it moved up by a hand. I saw the window open and the paper hangings move." Carolyn Barnes was incredibly descriptive too, telling all the inquest that, "At the same time, I observed a slight piece of paper with a red pattern hanging down outside the window." For decades to come, sleuths trying to solve the case would ponder this. Was it a piece of red patterned wallpaper she saw? Or was it white wallpaper that got bloody and stuck to someone's hand as they opened the window? At the main trial, Barnes again testified, saying the same thing. "I saw someone moving the paper on the Tuesday morning. The paper was very white outside." She clarified that this was about 9:40 in the morning. There was also the neighbor, Mrs. Pashley, who also lived across from Emsley. Pashley did not see the window or the hand moving it up, but she did notice the shutters left open. She last saw Emsley in front of the window between 7 and 8 p.m. Knowing Emsley went to bed at around 11 and always closed her shutters, she was shocked to see them still open at around midnight. It was so odd, she even said something about it to her mother at the time. It made her nervous that the shutters were still open the next morning, and she watched as several visitors walked up to Emsley's door and knocked, waited, and then left without gaining entrance. Mrs. Barnes also noted that a laborer named Davidson was at her home that very morning and witnessed exactly what she had. Even more unnerving was the realization that if Emsley was murdered in the early evening of the 13th, before it got dark, and Carolyn Barnes saw no one leave until the window slid open, this meant that the killer had likely stayed inside Nine Grove Road overnight with the woman he had just brutally murdered. What kind of a person could do such a thing? What kind of a monster would stick around afterward in a dark and empty home reeking of blood and decomposition? Even if Mullins' children had conspired to lie for their father, what reason would Mullins have for staying in the home all night after murdering the old woman? One might argue that he was scared and wanted to wait until the coast was clear, but if this was so, why wait until daytime when everyone had woken up and were knocking on Emsley's door before he would leave? And if Mullins was guilty, why would he implicate himself in the murder by going to the police of his own volition to tell them about the parcel? The math wasn't mathing. And if Mullins was guilty, why would he implicate himself in the murder by going to the police of his own volition to tell them about the parcel? The math wasn't mathing. The other witness to give the trial a shock was James Stevenson, a builder. Stevenson told the court that he had business on Grove Road the morning of Tuesday the 14th, the day after Emsley was allegedly murdered, and the morning that Mrs. Barnes saw someone inside the home just before 10 a.m. As Stevenson was leaving his business at 3 Grove Road, he was walking down the street and saw a man walk through someone's garden and out to the street with several rolls of wallpaper under their arm. He didn't recognize the guy at first, but soon turned the corner and came face to face with him. Stevenson found himself staring into the face of Mr. Rowland, one of Emsley's trusted rent collectors. "Hallo," Stevenson greeted Rowland. "Are you in the paper line?" The two knew each other, but Stevenson didn't know that Rowland had been selling wallpaper. Rowland responded, "Yes, didn't you know that?" Stevenson replied, "No, or else I might have given you a job or two." He said that Rowland seemed flustered, like Stevenson had caught him off guard. Mr. Rowland coolly took the stand and explained that the morning Stevenson was talking about was actually several days earlier than what Rowland claimed, and he wasn't leaving Emsley's house, he was leaving the house next door where he had been wallpapering. As to Stevenson, according to Rowland, well, he was, quote, "not quite right in his mind," end quote. And at that, most in the courtroom began to laugh and forget the matter. But still, something lingered in the courtroom. It was doubt. As the second day of the trial concluded, the jury retired to deliberate and returned after an hour with a verdict. Guilty. Mullins seemed confused and shocked at the verdict, so much so that his Irish accent snuck out a bit when he asked the judge to allow him to speak a few words. He reiterated that he was not guilty, that the day of the murder he was at work in Temple Place, until about 6 or 7 and then returned home to his children and did not leave until the following day. What I have stated now are the real facts, as the Lord is my judge, and he shall judge me before long. Mullins was not dejected, but nor was he aggressive. He seemed to have come to life with the verdict, as though now it was finally his chance to set the record straight. He was spirited. Speaking to the courtroom, Mullins made a fist and beat at his chest, and my heart, thump, is light at being able to tell my friends about me that what I say to you now is the real truth. It was a moving speech, but Mullins never addressed the most damning evidence against him, which was the parcel and his knowledge of it. The judge donned his black cap and passed the death sentence, telling Mullins that he should have addressed the issue of the stolen check, the one piece of evidence that connected Mullins so closely with the day of the murder. The Times commented on the sentence. The murder for which Mullins is to die was in the highest degree cold-blooded and cruel. To commit a crime and then to pocket the reward offered for the discovery by falsely denouncing another man is refinement of villainy which almost borders on romance. Mullins set to work on an appeal and wrote to the Home Secretary that he had not been convicted upon evidence, but upon prejudice. Mullins wanted a commutation, but he would have been happy with transportation, this being the time when criminals were sent off to some British colony or Australia. At least Mullins would be alive and would be able to take his family with him. This being the time when criminals were sent off to Australia or some British colony. At least Mullins would be alive and would be able to take his family with him. On the 18th of November, Mullins was informed that the Home Secretary found no reason to stop the death sentence. Well, I will not go before God with a lie in my mouth, but I am still innocent of this murder. Mullins was allowed a Catholic priest, with whom he spent his final days, but no confession came. The foul crime and the charge of which I have been found guilty through the most false and gross perjury that has ever been given in a court of justice. It's unclear what happened to change Mullins' mind, but before his execution, Mullins told all that he no longer believed Walter M. had any part in the murder. Had Mullins realized or been told something? Or did he not want the guilt of blaming another man for murder on his conscience as he was about to die? Around 20 to 30,000 people allegedly attended the hanging, making it the largest crowd seen at Newgate to date. Mullins would give no last speech, much to everyone's dismay. He walked out to the scaffold silently, and he died without much of a struggle. Mullins had written a letter to his son before being hanged, which was printed on a broadside. Broadsides are not the most reliable primary source because they frequently exaggerated and lied about things in order to sell papers. But there is one part of Mullins' letter to his son, copied in the broadside, that does seem pretty legitimate. "Government has treated me badly," it read. "I had thought, even if I failed to prove my innocence, that the services I rendered them would have been taken into account. Not so. The gallows is out, people are gathering around, the clock is going on, and I must die." Mullins' gripe with the government was not news. He felt abandoned and betrayed by the institution he had sacrificed and worked so hard for, and now he was to die for it as well. Arthur Conan Doyle was intrigued by the case. He was fascinated by the villainous hands sliding the window open, and by the circumstantial evidence that got Mullins convicted. Doyle did not believe, as the prosecution argued, that sometimes circumstantial evidence is the best way to find the truth in a criminal trial. Circumstantial evidence is a very tricky thing. Doyle wrote as Sherlock Holmes in the Boscombe Valley Mystery. It may seem to point very straight to one thing, but if you shift your own point of view a little, you may find it pointing in an equally uncompromising manner to something entirely different. In his opinion, all of the evidence collected against Mullins could be interpreted in other ways. Personally, Doyle thought it was likely Mullins was connected to the murder somehow, but that with the evidence presented at trial, he never should have been found guilty. There simply was not enough to prove that Mullins had killed Emsley. And it was Doyle who famously said, "It is better that 99 guilty should escape than one innocent man should suffer." As I've said before, everyone matters or no one does. We cannot rob someone of the right to a fair trial just because we are eager for someone to be punished for a crime. If it can be claimed that there is one chance in 100 in favor of the prisoner, he is entitled to his acquittal, Doyle argued. In this sense, he wished the English justice system worked the way it did in Scotland, where juries were able to declare not proven along with guilty or not guilty. If the lawyers had not proven a case against someone, then that person was released, though they did retain the not proven verdict throughout the remainder of their lives. Doyle never solved the mystery of who killed Mrs. Emsley, and yet the case was significant enough that he felt compelled to write about it, if only because he felt that there was a lot more to the story than just Mullins. During the time of the trial, many theories were floated, a lot of them revolving around the many people wishing to have some of Emsley's inheritance, which, by the way, would not end up going to the crown, but to Samuel Williams, Emsley's nephew. Author McKay believed the murderer was more apt to be discovered in the inheritance hearings after Mullins was already executed than in the murder trial itself. McKay did not believe that theft was the motive for murder. In explaining what he believed happened to Emsley, McKay argues that we must first stop thinking of the hammer as the murder weapon, and theft as the motive, as the police then did. Theft had always been a questionable motive, since even the items in the parcel were found to be worthless for the most part, and nothing was really taken from the home, despite the fact that they had the time and opportunity to take things. And especially since we know they were either stuck in the house all night, or at the very least had left and returned to the home. And then there was the fact that everyone knew Emsley did not keep things of value in her home anyway, and was so nervous about thieves that she left her rent collections in a safe at a pub up the street from her. Any burglary would be speculative at best, says McKay. Even the Illustrated Times printed that the jury that sent Mullins to his death must be nervous, for strong evidence exists that Mullins did not commit the crime for which he suffered. Ever since the murder was announced, people speculated that there might have been more than one killer, or at least more than one man involved in the crime. Perhaps Mullins did not kill the old lady himself, but played some other role in the crime. Or vice versa, Mullins killed Emsley and someone helped him, though this version is not as likely. Journalists printed one theory of the murder in which Mullins, angry at Emsley and her refusal to even provide him with the correct materials to do the job assigned, had visited Emsley to help her do something on the 13th, and then he snapped and killed her. Perhaps she was teasing him, as she liked to do, or flaunting her will, or who knows what, to piss him off. He snaps and hits her over the head, and then has no choice but to see it through, and kill her to cover it up. In the journalist's version, Mullins' eldest son John, the one who was away sailing in the ocean somewhere, was there to help his father cover up the murder, perhaps stealing a few things before they snuck out the next morning, and then conspired to frame Walter M. so that they wouldn't be suspected. But this would imply that Mullins either knew that M would have no alibi for the night, or were too dumb to even consider such a thing. Mullins was not dumb, though. In fact, he was formerly a policeman and would have known all about how these investigations went. As to the son, there literally isn't anything that says for sure he was even in London at the time. It's like his name was just brought into the investigation for funsies. McKay's theory of the murderer makes much more sense. In McKay's version, the killer was someone well known by Emsley and was admitted immediately without the widow having to look out the window and talk to them. Plus, he was someone who constantly visited the home and would have been immediately overlooked. The man was Joseph Biggs, the man who helped Emsley with all of her correspondences. Biggs was an apostolic minister, a man of God, and said to be on intimate terms with Emsley. In fact, Biggs told the court that he had proposed marriage to her on several occasions and argued that there was no one closer to her than he. Emsley did not decline his proposals, which was the part Biggs kept repeating to the court, rather than saying she did not say yes. Technically, Biggs was her amanuensis. Basically, a fancy word for someone who takes dictation. As Emsley was illiterate, she had Biggs write everything for her. This put him on very intimate terms with the widow, as he would have known exactly who she was talking to and what she was saying at all times for the last 4 years of her life. Biggs admitted that they saw each other frequently, at least once a week. Biggs usually visited her on Sundays, and thus was at Grove Road the day before she was killed. He was due to meet Emsley on Tuesday the 14th, the morning Mrs. Barnes saw the hand move in the bedroom window. And yet, Biggs was late. He was due to meet a Mr. Jones at 9 Grove Road at 11, but he was late and did not arrive until 1:30. Biggs did not see Jones, and Emsley did not answer the door, so he left. McKay argued that Biggs would easily be able to come and go from the home without too much of a fuss, but he speculates that his relationship with Emsley was strained. He wanted to marry her, but she was not accepting. He wanted her to make a will, but she was procrastinating. He wanted her to finally give some of her money to his church, but she wasn't doing it. She swore that she would leave everything to charity, and yet all spare money she had went right to the purchase of even more property. Perhaps Biggs had been hounding her over these things, and perhaps Emsley was tired of Biggs being on her back all the time. Perhaps Biggs visited her in the evening of August 13th. And perhaps Emsley was not all too happy to see him, given how much he had been pestering her lately, so she does not light the candles in her home. She wanted Biggs to see how dark it was getting and know that he was not welcome to stay for long. Mrs. Emsley had a weird obsession with the wallpapers she had purchased, and so perhaps the two made their way upstairs, and as Emsley is talking about the wallpapers, she says something that makes Biggs' skin boil. Whatever she has said has outraged him, and this time he cannot contain himself. He grabs his walking cane, the one that oh so many London gentlemen walked around with, and rams it into the side of her skull. Emsley did not see it coming. Her death came as a complete shock, as it also might have been for Biggs, who realized that now he had to go all the way to ensure the old woman was dead for sure. For him, out of fear that he would be arrested as a murderer, but second for Mrs. Emsley, whose soul was currently trying to make its way to heaven in his eyes. When Mrs. Emsley is dead for certain, he panics. He sees his hands covered in blood and bends down to grab at Emsley's petticoat to wipe them off, pulling her skirts up in the process. To atone for what he did, big stays and prays over Emsley's body throughout the night. In the morning, he wakes to the choking stench of a decaying body and runs to the window to get some fresh air. He did not realize that a piece of wallpaper had become stuck to his hand with blood, nor that there was a woman across the street watching the window rise. When he feels it safe, Biggs walks out onto the street, knowing the bloodstains would not show on his all-black clothing. After he cleans himself up, Biggs returns to the scene of the crime for his meeting, knowing he is too late for it, so instead he slips his calling card under the door so that when the police come, they will know he was trying to get inside that morning. It's a great theory, very Sherlockian, particularly with the details of the wallpaper scraps sticking to the murderer's hand, and the all-black clothing disguising the blood that would have exposed anyone else. But it almost seems too neat for this incredibly messy case. Like, McKay had grabbed at all the case's loose ends and formulated a theory that answered them all. My problem with this theory is that there were way too many suspects, again, at a time so long ago that how could we possibly point the finger at one man and be so certain about him? It's not as though McKay introduced new evidence when he cited Minister Biggs as the murderer, either. Nothing new had come to light, and there was never any solid evidence against him. I understand McKay's desire to debate other suspects, though. Most people who doubt Mullen's guilt try to determine who else the killer could have been, which is only natural. For instance, I personally wanted to know a lot more about one person mentioned throughout the trial, 25-year-old William Rowland. Rowland, if you recall, was Mullen's colleague, performing much of the same tasks as Mullins did for Emsley, though Rowland had been around longer and was more trusted. On August 13th, Rowland was the one to break up the spat between the widow and her tenant. Rowland had been with Walter M. and his family later in the afternoon, all the way up until Rowland saw them into the carriage that took them into Stratford. Rowland returned, according to some sources, at 6:30, and according to others, it was near 9 p.m. Also, like Mullins, William Rowland had previously been a warrant officer. He was stationed at the Worship Street Police Station, but no word on what happened to his career. And it was Rowland whom Stevenson said he saw early on the morning of Tuesday the 14th, emerging from Emsley's home at a time when she was already dead. Rowland's response was to call Stevenson an idiot and say he was wrong about the day he saw him. Was this ever confirmed, though? Did anyone ever follow up on this? McKay does not give Rowland an alibi, though he does quote Rowland as saying that he was 2 miles away at the time of the murder. But again, 2 miles away where and when? Was he talking about his trip to see the M's off to Stratford? Because everyone noted that he left them when the carriage departed. At the inquest and the trial, Rowland made a point of explaining how strange Mullins was acting after the murder. He described Mullins as very much agitated when he saw him, and described how Mullins had left jobs unfinished at the time of the murder. This was common for laborers, though, who often had to start a job somewhere and then come back and return to it later. But Rowland made this seem sinister. Before the drama began, Rowland and Mullins were walking together when someone stopped them to ask if they heard an old woman had been murdered on Grove Road. Rowland told the jury that Mullins developed a tremor when the man said so, and added, "I hope it is not Mrs. Emsley." The two men went to finish their wallpaper job, but Rowland explained that Mullins was acting funny. "I found his work was done in a very strange manner," Rowland said. "The paper was all turned upside down, and his mode of doing things was more like a person that was imbecile than anything else." Rowland finished his task in the home, left, and then was told that the murdered woman was Mrs. Emsley. He then returned to tell this to Mullins, who said he was suddenly acting nervous and asking Rowland to go grab a drink with him to discuss it. While at the pub two doors down, drinking rum, Rowland watched Mullins and noticed that his appearance indicated something very extraordinary. He was pale and he shook and trembled, which gave me a notion at the time that there was something very wrong about him. Rowland ran into Mullins about a week or so later, and they both asked each other if they had any news about the murder, and began to discuss it once more. Mullins, I suspect a man very strongly, and I have got him in my mind's eye now, and I will not lose sight of him till the perpetrator of this diabolical murder has been discovered. Rowland explained that Mullins then assumed a very ghastly appearance. A pallor came over him, a death-like hue, and he said, I suspect the man likewise, and I am watching him now. Rowland replied, I believe, Mullins, the man I suspect is not the man you suspect. There at the main trial, Rowland was repeating much of what he said at the inquest about Mullins acting strangely anxious after the murder. Only at the main trial, he significantly amps up the drama. There at the main trial, Rowland was repeating much of what he said at the inquest about Mullins acting strangely anxious after the murder. Only at the main trial, he significantly amps up the drama. It really seems as though Rowland had a personal stake in seeing Mullins convicted for the murder. What of Mullins, then? Could it be that Mullins had been pilfering relatively worthless items from Mrs. Emsley prior to her murder, angry at her behavior and banking on her not realizing they were missing? Could it be that Mullins was a thief, but not a murderer? Why else would his wife sell a pencil case he had stolen from Emsley's home? If he were the killer, surely the Mullins would have been more careful about selling the stolen goods. This might make sense if Mullins believed he would be harming his family by admitting to stealing the goods from Emsley. When he died, he would leave that burden on his wife and children, not to mention the stain on their names. And let's not forget that at the time, everyone believed that whoever hid the parcel must be the murderer. Perhaps Mullins believed that in admitting to theft, he would also be admitting to murder. He maintained his innocence to the end. He declared, I make this statement in order that the public may know that my life has been taken away by the most gross and false evidence ever given in a court of justice, all through the hopes of getting money. Several times he swore he was innocent, as God is my witness. Maybe Mullins had nothing to do with the theft, or the murder. Maybe Mullins really did see M or someone else do something shady and he truly believed he was on the path of the killer. Did the one-time copper see this as his opportunity to prove to the English crown that he was a valuable agent? Maybe Mullins mourned his career as detective, and when Emsley was murdered, he felt called to investigate, first for the poor woman he worked for, and second to redeem himself. Imagine if he, Mullins, single-handedly solved one of London's greatest murder mysteries. Was he beginning to envision new futures for himself and his family as he made his way to Officer Tanner to tell him about the parcel? We will never know, and that is precisely the point. There were far too many suspects, far too many people who wished Emsley harm, and far too many people with access to her home after her purchase of all the wallpapers. The case was unprovable in all directions, particularly after Mrs. Barnes' testimony about the hand in the window. Because ultimately, McKay argues that, quote, if Mullins did the crime, he did it in an entirely different way to that which the police imagined, end quote. This alone should have spared Mullins from the noose.
Good morning.
That's it for today, but I'll be back real soon. Promise. If you enjoyed the episode, please be kind enough to leave us a review, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. For more info and photos on this episode, check out our Instagram by searching for Old Blood Podcast. And same goes for our Patreon, which is now up and running. Music credits to Facilian Studios, Holizna, and the original sung by Virginia Liston in 1926.